Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our minds for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast number 181. Before we get started, we want to throw out a quick thank you to everybody who came out to the Pride Party on Saturday night.
That was actually super fun.
Yep. There were treats, there was disco balls, there were fancy hats.
Yep, there was bumping music.
Bumping beats. Bumping booty beats, as promised.
As promised.
I might have been the only one who promised that.
No, it was really good, and it was nice to be able to chat it up with some folks who are customers and friends and things like that, but who, you know, I don't always have a chance to talk to as much.
No, mostly because you live in a hermit cave.
A little bit, yeah, sometimes.
But we brought the pride to the hermit cave.
You just run with it. Imagine the slow looming disco beats getting louder. Louder until the stalactites are shaking with them. All right.
Reminder that we're doing the roundup charity for the month is going to be the Rebuild Texas Fund to rebuild after Hurricane Harvey. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of response on that. I think we have a good donation to make at the end of the month.
Yep, I've had several customers, you know, go kind of above and beyond with their donations. Yep. It's really sweet of them. Happy to see that that's going well, and thank you to folks who have chipped in on that.
Also, we're still starting to get the board game nights going on Tuesdays. Apparently, I'm going to be working Tuesdays now, so I'll be here. I'll be your board game maestro. I can tell you what games are in our demo library you should definitely play and which ones you definitely shouldn't.
I call you MC Carcassonne.
And come on out on Tuesday and play board games with us. Like I say, the turnout's a little small right now, but we were hoping to sort of build that up into a thing. This Saturday, September 23rd, is Batman/Harley Quinn Day. So we will have numerous things going on this weekend. For one thing, there's three, not one, not two, but three free comics.
Yep.
Yeah, there's a Batman comic, there's a Harley Quinn comic, and there's a DC Superhero Girls comic. You can come on and get one or two or all three.
DC Superhero Girls is an unstoppable force, and people should just accept it and buy it for their kids.
Give in to the DC Superhero Girls before it destroys you.
Yes.
Are people not giving in? Is this a thing?
Actually, I believe they are all giving in, so this advice is useless. I just want the masters at DC Superhero Girls to know that I am behind their plan and not punish me.
I'm just happy there was a person who came in looking for a specific katana thing. And we actually have a DC Supergirls Gatana novel.
That's awesome.
So I'm like, I have fulfilled this.
It's kind of like
Squirrel Girl being a thing.
Yeah.
Who thought Katana would have her have a following?
The other day, I went by Toys R Us for, I'm going to say, the first time in years.
Yep.
And right before they decided to bankrupt themselves.
Yeah, I guess so.
What did you do?
What have you done?
You know those big domino things that last for like 10 minutes?
Yeah.
I bumped into one of those.
Did you push the red button?
Yes. No, they had. So I was looking at their Lego section, and they had some DC Superhero Girls one there. First of all, I learned that their Eclipso is a girl in this one.
Okay, yep.
And probably, I'm guessing, one of the big bads, maybe.
Wouldn't that be Eclipsa?
Only if you needed to make it a sexist spelling.
I have to.
And for all I know, they did, and I just didn't read close enough. It's possible. The bigger point is, it was one of those large sets. Like, I'm betting it cost somewhere between 60 and 80 or even 100 bucks. There is an Eclipso for girls set, and not just girls, but, like, geared for, I guess, that costs $100 as a Lego. That is the world we're living in.
We're moving forward.
We're making
progress.
Damn straight.
I'm just curious. Is it like a set that's like the school?
For $100,
you should get.
It was like Eclipso's palace or something like that. It was like a villain lair.
It's like a rival school.
Yeah, that would actually be really cool.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
Also, we will have 15% off. 15% off. I should clarify that.
1/5.
1/5 off of Batman and Harley Quinn comics and merchandise for the day. We will have a Catwoman out here starting about 11 o'clock, possibly some Harley Quinns. We don't know yet. There's paper masks of Batman and Harley Quinn. You can see, if you're friends with Nick on Facebook, you can see him modeling it.
That's true.
There we'll have those free while supplies last, so come on out. Also, we're having a Batman the Animated Series dice game demo at 1 o'clock.
Ooh.
So all kinds of stuff.
And if you guys have costumes, come out in costume.
Yes, come out in costume.
I want to see your Harley Quinns and Batmans.
That'd be amazing.
And Catwomans and Jokers.
T-shirts and stuff are cool.
Yeah.
But if you've got a costume, that's the best. Or if you can, Quinn up some face makeup, that'd be sweet.
Yep.
By the way, we haven't talked about this, but on our TV, I think we should for sure pull up the Harley Batman animated episodes.
Oh, yeah.
Get those up and running and stuff.
Good idea.
mad love and all of the best.
Is the animated Batman Harley thing, is that hit yet, or is that? Or...
I think that has hit. Yes.
I might have to check that out. I have to find that.
I think I heard mixed stuff. Yep. Just be a little cautious.
Okay. Also, Sunday is our Magic the Gathering Ixalan pre-release.
Ixalan.
So I believe you still got space for people to sign up.
Yep.
So you can come up, play Magic, and then that next weekend, Saturday, September 30th, will be our draft weekend. We'll try out the draft for the new set. And that's also Ladies' Night. You can come out. Wicked and Divine is the book they're going to read.
Yep.
So you can pick up Wicked and Divine Volume 1 and come talk about it with your fellow ladies.
That's the book that's the hotness.
It is. And then first week of October, Saturday, October 7th, from 1 to 4 p.m., we are doing a DC deck building game tournament. Yes. With some prizes like Vixen cards and a couple other cards.
Yeah. Again, like I mentioned last week, I've had some people asking for it. I know there's going to be some fans of the game out there to try it out and throw down with some people. So it's like the coolest game ever.
Yep.
Basically, we all have really enjoyed it. Yep. And DC, or the Cryptozoic, right?
Yeah.
They support it really well. It's got a ton of great expansions and stuff. So I would imagine, Randy, it's not like a demo per se. This is really more for people
who want to play it.
Right. Yeah. But if you haven't played it, you can kind of kick back and watch and see these characters and stuff flying. And
also, see if you haven't played it and you've played deck builders, you can get in it pretty quickly.
Absolutely.
All right, news. There's some news this week. So let's start with, we've seen what David Harbour looks like as Hellboy.
Yes.
And he looks like Ron Perlman.
A little bit.
Long hair.
It may be that Ron Perlman looks like Hellboy.
It's a good shot, though.
Oh, it looks fantastic.
Yeah. The only thing that doesn't look like Mignola's artwork is that he has shoulders.
Yes, he has shoulders. And that is only because plastic surgery is not advanced to the point where...
I like to imagine he's doing, like, ankle wraps, a tape wrap around his ankles to get that thin ankle thinness of...
Does Ron Perlman not have shoulders? He has shoulders.
Yeah, I know, but, like,
but
it's
Hellboy
been... It's been a declining thing. The same tech that gave us Hobbits, though, I feel could shrink his shoulders down.
You think that's what they should have spent the special effects on?
Yeah. Well, that's going to be when they remake Hellboy, reboot it for a third time.
Yes. No shoulders.
They're like, well, what's-his-name was good, but he had shoulders.
This will be the trending hashtag no shoulders.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
No, it looks good. He's standing there looking like a badass, basically. Does he have, like, his pistol out and stuff?
Yeah, I think he does.
Sort of, I'm going to call it the get-some look for Hellboy. I think I saw universally pleased reactions.
They recast Ben Daimio with Daniel Day-Kim is playing him.
Yep.
Which is pretty awesome.
Yep. I think you made the good point, Randy. Like in the books, this guy is like a grizzled soldier, almost Cable-like.
Yeah.
You know, with the scarred face, and he's like a real hard ass. Although he's got a little heart to him, as I recall. Yeah. It's been a little while since I've read stuff with him, but. And you were saying Daniel Day-Kim doesn't always do that, but he's had some turns on, like, Lost and other shows where he kind of gets pretty fierce, and I can see it.
Also, if they can take away shoulders, they can add scars.
I guess. I don't see how. How could you possibly do scar makeup? Whatever. this was a pretty happy resolution to... a kind of a whitewashing issue where the actor who had originally been cast gracefully stepped down and kind of did the cool thing.
It's a classy move.
Yep, and they hired an actor that people are digging. People will hopefully then say, there can be a little bit of forgiveness, you know, we're not going to destroy the movie because you did this, because eventually you got to the right place. Just don't do it again, Hollywood.
Yeah.
Learn some lessons from this stuff.
Yeah.
Jesus.
They're making a Strangers in Paradise movie, apparently, or at least it's being...
Oh, really?
They're talking about it. The director...
I didn't know that.
Angela Robinson, who directed the Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman movie recently...
Yeah.
...is working on adapting Strangers in Paradise for the screen. So, it's not a done deal or anything, but they're working on it.
I guess you did mention that earlier, but somehow it didn't connect in my head that was Strangers in Paradise.
Yep.
For those who haven't read it, because it hasn't been as big as it was in, like, the 90s, it was kind of one of the breakout indie black and white creator-owned self-published books of the 90s when there was a boom in that for a little while.
Yep.
That was sort of about a romantic triangle. It was...
Was that Terry Moore's first thing?
Other than whatever, you know, college comic strips and things he had done.
It's also noted in this article that basically Moore, and I've forgotten this, despite how long it ran, it ran from 93 all the way to 2000-something.
I was going to say, I hit the 2000s.
He was the only author and artist who ever worked on it. There was no, nobody came in and did the Adventures of Catch You separately. But it's interesting because it is a it's sort of got a little bit of a lesbian overtone because it's Kachu who falls for her best friend Francine, who is straight.
Yep.
And then she meets Kachu meets David, who is sort of interested in her as well.
Yep.
And then there's like crime and there's prostitution.
A crime subplot that runs heavily, either more heavily or more lightly. I can actually see this adapted pretty well.
Oh, I can too.
In fact, I think it could be used to like kind of bolster up some of the slightly weaker points.
Yeah, I think tightened up for a movie, it might actually be stronger.
Yeah.
I have a huge fondness. This is actually the comic book series How I Met My Wife.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So it sort of ties into.
It's like for all y'all are like Usenet circles and stuff like that,
much.
Right?
And also, I've met Terry Moore. We met him at the Chicago Con at a gathering for the group, and he's a Houston creator, so he's a local guy. So this is all good. This would be great if this could happen. Maybe bring to prominence a sort of '90s indie book that has been a little bit forgotten, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe bring to prominence his other series as well.
Yeah, he has actually been pretty prolific, and this is something else. It seems like when he starts a project, he generally completes it.
Yeah,
and he's got like several nice big, mega volumes that were
for
comprised
like all of Rachel Rising, all of Motor Girl just started up not too long ago.
Yeah, it's in the works, but yeah, Rachel Rising, Echo.
Yep, Echo,
and. I feel like there's one more.
Yeah, I feel like there is one.
What was the premise of Echo?
It was a woman who got she got attached to sort of experimental technology kind of thing.
Okay, that's right. That's right.
So that's cool, and we'll see where that goes. Like I say, it's just early
it
in development.
It should become a success, and then there should be a spate of Terry Moore adaptations that are all good.
Yes, that's a good idea. I'm on board. So Jamie Lee Curtis is apparently returning to. Halloween.
Yeah, they're actually doing a reimagining of Halloween, but I guess it's like a continuation.
One?
Yeah?
A continuation of her run, not say the Rob Zombie remakes?
I believe so.
So she tweeted out, same porch, same clothes, same issues 40 years later, headed back to Haddonfield one last time for Halloween. David Gordon Green, co-creator of HBO's Eastbound and Down and director of Pineapple Express and Our Brand is Crisis, is helming the new movie. With a script co-written by him and Danny McBride. That does not sound like the team to be doing Halloween.
Are they doing... Is it a spoof?
Maybe.
Is it a spoof about, like, a, middle-aged lady or that's having to deal with, like, this in a comedic way?
I don't know.
I almost think that's a better idea in a way, although, I mean, like, not a big
Danny
McBride
guys
might
try to do a straight...
It's happened. I mean... We weren't prepared for Key and Peele to, Jordan Peele to do Get Out,
and
then
by
like
Blumhouse is involved in this apparently.
Okay, so that sounds more serious.
Yeah.
Unless they're branching out and trying out a comedy.
Well, here's the other thing: the guys behind Preacher. That's not the kind of thing they would have done either. So
it's true.
These guys are trying to branch out.
Preacher did have does have some anarchic humor, like a lot of it to it, but it's
the
also
the only downside for me, of course, is that I don't have any funds for Halloween, and I. Hated Pineapple Express and he spent it down.
And Danny McBride in general.
Except
in the that one movie.
Yes.
Yeah. Which I'm blanking on the name of.
End Times, then.
Oh, yeah.
The end of.
End of Days, though.
No, that's a stupid Schwarzenegger.
End of the World.
End of the World.
Yes.
I did like him in that.
Yeah.
And I also liked him in the jungle movie that we all liked. Tropic Thunder. Yeah.
Right.
He does have some good moments.
Yes, he does. I like him in small doses. I do not like him in starring HBO roles.
No, Vice Principals and Eastbound and Down. Neither of them really hit me.
And I have friends who love it. I do not.
Yeah.
Speaking of dicey reboots, Blade Runner is getting a short anime from Cowboy Bebop's director.
It's called Blade Runner
Blackout 2022.
Is it bad that I'm more excited for this than the actual movie?
No, I am also more excited for this. It's kind of like, remember how good, I mean, I know Dave does, you remember how good the Animatrix was.
Yeah.
And all the Matrix sequels were terrible.
Yeah. Right. If they had been of the quality of Animatrix, then it would be like rivaling Star Wars as the most legendary trilogy of all time.
Yeah. But yeah, give me a Blade Runner anime, I'm all about that. That sounds great.
Yeah,
especially
that does.
The guy that Cowboy Bebop.
Mm-hmm.
They've got some production stills and a little trailer and stuff, and it looks cool.
Does it have any particular mission statement, like it'll bridge the gap between the original and the new? Or
Watanabe says he's keeping two things in mind: paying maximum respect to the original Blade Runner and trying not to create an imitation. That's two very different things.
Yeah.
We want it to be exactly like the thing we love, but totally different.
I think it'd be the story. It should be the story of the guy who just makes eyes. Actually, they never showed his fate, but I'm not 100% sure that guy lived. I'm
pretty sure he died.
Pretty sure he died.
Yeah, pretty sure Roy Batty killed him. Actually, I think in general, if in Blade Runner...
If Roy Batty, talked to you,
he killed you.
He probably killed
that's
you.
That's for Deckard.
Yeah.
For Blade Runner.
I think that's true.
He did, however, kill the hatred within his Deckard's heart.
Yes, he did.
I keep seeing the new Blade Runner trailer, though, and I'm just like, this doesn't do anything for me.
I want it to be good.
I mean, you know what my biggest problem is? It looks too pretty. It looks so overthought in a way. Like, it needs to be almost, I mean, it needs to be messier.
Well, the thing is, I like all the people involved. I really do like all those actors and actresses.
I'm not sure I like Denis Villeneuve, because I've only seen that one movie he did.
And that's
which
sort of...
was a drug movie.
Sicario,
okay. Which I did not love.
Okay.
Yeah. I haven't seen Arrival. I know that there's a split opinion of the management team.
I keep on forgetting about that.
Because you
is there a split opinion?
You did not love Arrival. You liked Arrival, right?
I actually fell more into Dave's camp.
No split decision. I should see it and see if we're all agreed that Arrival is stinky poo.
I think we're gonna all be agreed.
So that is the crack in the armor of Blade Runner. It's like I'm not a big fan of that director, so we'll see.
But here's one thing I can say with confidence. I'm going on my segues to get it, guys.
I like it.
It will be better than Krypton Season 1. Which, however, is going to feature Adam Strange.
It would be funny, and I know they're not going to do this, I suspect they're not going to do this. Yep. It would be funny if they did the approach of Gotham, and it was just bonkers, batshit insane.
It does seem like, I mean, here's the deal. We're following Seg-El, Cameron Cuff, as the House of El is being ostracized and shamed. He fights for redemption and finds an unlikely mentor in Adam Strange.
Like a time-displaced Adam Strange? You got Zeta beamed?
Or is it just that Adam Strange is playing an older character in this, and so if you go back a little ways, he can still be a... He can still be a
But he's
adult.
Not going to get younger as time passes.
This is like this is like Jor-El's father, right?
Oh, is it that far back?
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot it was that far back.
So
then that's got to be time displaced or something like that.
What if when you go to Rand, the Zeta Beam ages you in reverse?
Actually, you know what? They could do something where like all of his various trips have been like time distorted because of gravitational lensing or something.
So in the future, they could bring him in, then they can bring him into the Flash or into Gotham maybe as baby Adam Strange.
Is it possible with the showrunners for this new Krypton show really don't give a damn and just want to use a character?
It is possible.
And they're not going to think about it too much.
You know who I want them to use? I want them to use that villain, that bad villain from recent Superman comics, Hell, or Hell.
Yeah,
if that's indeed what it's supposed to be pronounced as.
That sounds great.
I mean, this show was not going to be anything, right?
It might be Gotham.
It could be. It could be bonkers Gotham.
Is it going to
But I think it's... You know what I think it's going to be? I think it's going to be muted Superman v. Batman, Man of Steel, kind of.
What if the kid who's playing Bruce Wayne shows up on Krypton in his weird Batman suit?
That's not a good idea.
You know, there's a link to be had there because the Nightwing name came from a character from
true.
Krypton, right?
That's true.
What if Bruce Wayne from Gotham becomes Nightwing on Krypton before Nightwing actually becomes Nightwing?
A time-displaced Adam Strange brings him to be the partner, except a mentor, in this case because of time displacement, to young Bruce Wayne.
Bruce Wayne by Nightwing. Who
See,
is himself.
Now you're thinking Gotham stuff.
Yes, now I'm thinking Gotham stuff. And then someone ties balloons to people and murders them.
I will say this, there's you know, I don't know much of Krypton's various history in the comics because usually it hasn't been that interesting. Byrne did some interesting stuff. There's some bonkers stories like Nightwing and Flamebird from the old Silver Age. But if I were making the show, I would go ahead and draw on all of that stuff. Yeah. You know, I would have the, what is it, like that sort of eugenics wars or whatever that Byrne did.
Sure, yeah.
And then I would have Nightwing and Flamebird as like, you know, like vigilantes or whatever in there. You might have to change Nightwing because that's just so identifiable now, but I would go ahead and have some variant of them. You can do a pretty heavy rethink.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but in Kryptonian, the S stands for hope.
Oh.
So his actual name is Hoperman. They don't call him that.
Hope punch.
Hoperman.
Hope kick.
Hope headbutt.
Hope breath.
Anyway, in TV news I'm a little more excited about,
and also, hope X-ray vision.
Also still worry about, True Lies, the comedy, the action comedy movie that was Schwarzenegger and Jim Cameron, which I believe...
Jamie Lee Curtis, the star of the new Halloween reboot.
And Jamie Lee Curtis. I believe this was the movie he should have made sequels to instead of making four more Avatars.
Oh God, is there four?
Well, supposedly. We still need one.
It's really kind of all just stuff on weirdness on his hard drive.
But that Fox has announced a pilot commitment to make a True Lies TV show with Mick G, who you might know from...
Charlie's Angels. And also, producing...
He's also involved in the series 9-1-1 for Fox. He's also done a variety of shows like Fastlane and he directed the pilot for Lethal Weapon.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Maybe that's the TV thing and I was thinking of that awful MacGyver thing. Yeah. I mean, I hope so.
It also involves Arrow co-creator and X-Men Gold writer Mark Guggenheim.
The Googster.
And James Cameron's Lightstorm Entertainment. So they're talking about doing a pilot. There's been no update on exactly what that means. Like, basically, I would hope that they would start with... Have we talked about this? I think we did.
I don't think I did. Unless we talked about a hypothetical what we would have done once.
Yeah, we did
time.
That a long time
ago.
I thought
we talked hypothetical about doing a True Lies TV show because you start with...
You
start with the movie. You start with him with his wife not knowing, and then the series becomes about them working together because that's the thing we didn't see after the movie.
Right.
Yeah. Do you think that's what they'll do, or do you think they'll do like the young Arnold Schwarzenegger? I can't remember the character's name.
Harry Tasker.
That's.
I don't know.
I think I would rather go ahead and see the continuation. And you know what I kind of like, and the reason I don't want to see a young one was because the whole point was that they were. You know, they were kind of like hitting middle age.
Yeah.
She was feeling a little out of sorts and restless.
She had to go sleep with a car salesman.
And then she did a sexy dance and fixed everything.
Yes.
Which is how you know James Cameron really understands people.
my worry is...
Let me just say it was a great movie, though.
It was a great movie. That's not an unfair assessment of how things go. She did a sexy dance. He killed a bunch of people.
But they were all bad.
And grabbed her with a helicopter out of a limousine.
And he shot a terrorist off with a missile.
And all the family crisis was solved.
Yeah. That might have also not been a super sensitive treatment of those of the Islamic faith.
It was not.
But here's my thing is that without Arnold and Jamie Lee Curtis, who brought a lot of charisma to those roles...
You need a giant Austrian.
You would need a giant Austrian.
Like 12 feet tall.
Actually, what I think they're going to probably do... I think they're going to get a white dude, probably, who will become him.
I bet they don't.
You don't think so? I think, by the way, I do think that the biggest thing is, that, honestly, Arnold's physicality. And I think that they need to, whoever he plays him, needs to be, even though he's supposed to be a spy, does need to be a big guy. Whoever it is needs to have... broad chest, kind of big shoulders and stuff like that. He needs to be action spy, not... because that's who Schwarzenegger embodied in the movie, not a Bond spy.
Yeah, that's true. But he was also a Bond spy, because remember he put on like a tux and danced?
Yeah. Part of what was so fun about that, I think, was that it was Arnold Schwarzenegger doing it, though.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I don't think... I mean, I think it'd be crazy if they somehow actually went for like an Austrian or something like that. I don't think they would do
it. But you're right, he needs to be sort of a big guy. He needs to be a rock type dude or something like that.
Yes, that exactly.
Yeah. Also, he rode a horse into an elevator.
Yes, he did.
Sorry.
People, you should watch True Lies. Watch True Lies. It's a great movie.
I can watch it right now.
If only it was on Blu-ray.
Yeah, it is on Blu-ray.
Is it?
I own it on Blu-ray, so I assume it is.
Okay. I thought for
maybe
the longest
you got
time it wasn't.
Bootleg from a vending machine in Japan.
It's possible, except I've never been to Japan.
That you know of.
The
drugs are working. He remembers nothing.
Wait, who are you? What am I doing here?
Proceed with the podcast, fool.
All right.
Anyway, like, but I do think this could be a neat idea. They show the further adventures of the couple.
Yep.
And I think, you know what I think would be kind of fun? I would throw in a rival couple. Another couple that's like the kind of...
Oh, that'd be cool.
That was like almost like the Cheers rivalry with Gary's Old Town Tavern.
Yes.
Maybe these guys are actually a little bit better than them and more polished.
I like it.
Yeah.
And I would bring Tom Arnold back. Because what's Tom Arnold doing?
No. You get a Tom Arnold type.
Yes, you get a Tom Arnold type. Yeah. You get Danny McBride.
Honestly, yeah, it'd be one of those ones he probably would actually be a fit.
He'd be good for that role.
Yeah, we'll allow it, McBride.
We'll allow for Danny McBride. Moving on to game news. There is a new season of Pandemic called Pandemic Survival. It's basically something they're going to play in
convention. You said a new season, but this is
a new game,
this is a new game. but are also they're also going to play it at like all the conventions and stuff.
Okay.
It's competitive Pandemic.
In teams, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. So basically, the tournaments take place across the globe, but there is also going to be a game to be released called Pandemic Survival. And yeah, as we understand it, there's like two teams working sort of against the clock.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, exactly what the deal is, we don't know. But it is a sort of competitive version of Pandemic. Okay, so yeah, each team faces the same situation, identical roles, and infected cities, same player cards in the same order. Only their strategic choices can differentiate them. That's interesting.
I like the idea of a competitive Pandemic game as a change-up.
Yep.
I mean, obviously the great thing about Pandemic is that it is one of the absolute flagship cooperative games.
Yep.
But the mechanics, among its other mechanics, the way the viruses spread, the way the powers interact and stuff like that, there, you know, it has more going on than just its cooperative factors.
Right.
So I would, at this point, you know, I'm willing to try anything that these guys have done.
Same.
I also liked the dice game that they put out. Is a lot of fun.
Oh, I know you played that.
Yeah, I played it a little bit. It was a great version that echoed elements of the game, but definitely played differently enough, and I think maybe slightly brisker, like when you know what you're doing, you maybe play like the dice game in half an hour instead of 45 minutes to an hour.
Comic news. Couple notable things.
Like?
Jean Grey is coming back.
Yes.
Spoiler warning.
Jean Grey is the person, she's been dead for like 13 years, which in Marvel terms is basically forever.
You know what is funny is like, there is, the cliche is that like people will talk about like how they're always bringing her back. But I think when we tried to like kind of run the numbers on this, although Claremont went to that well a lot with stories about the Phoenix Resurrection, a lot of them were sort of like side stories. I mean, I remember like in Micronauts and other stories that he would tease it or have it in these. It happened in that X-Men Teen Titans crossover. But it was never, those weren't like really canonical, those, or they were kind of like side ideas about it.
Mm-hmm.
The actual number of times she's been resurrected is only like a handful of times, like twice maybe?
Yeah.
It gets a little dodgy because, you know, there is the suggestion that when she wrote Rose as Phoenix, she wasn't actually Jean.
Right.
That was sort of the retcon that they did to allow her. And so in that sense, I guess Jean had actually never truly died, according to that. She was just in a cocoon at the bottom of the harbor.
Like you
or
do.
Whatever. Like you do. In comics, that absolutely is like you
like
do.
It's like when people say your dog went off to a farm, and you find it actually went off to a farm.
Yeah.
when they talk
and he's
about,
been resurrected with nigh omnipotent power.
Right, exactly like that.
So Wolverine killed her.
Yep. In Morrison's run.
So
Matthew Rosenberg and Lionel Francis Yu are writing a Phoenix Resurrection, a miniseries maybe?
It's part of the whole Resurrection event.
Oh,
yeah.
What's the Resurrection event?
All the X-Men gold and all that stuff.
Ah, right.
Or is there an event?
I think there's an event coming down the road that is going to...
So,
I don't know, that might be where we get Xavier again, where we get... I'm speculating, I don't know, but it would make sense.
By the way, I was
making stuff up.
I was trying to think back. Wolverine killed her like as like some sort of merciful mercy killing because they were going into like the sun or something like that. I remember they were like crashing into it. They were like in a Shire ship or something. I don't know. I'll have to reread it and see what the context was. But I remember it wasn't just like, "Hey, Genie, stab."
Oswald.
It wasn't pranking her with a tire.
I feel like they tried to mirror that in like an X3. Like she was about to destroy something and she.
Right, right. There, that was for sure. That was really more the equivalent of the ending of the original Dark Phoenix saga, where it's like she turns off her powers for a second so that someone can kill her before she goes too far.
Right.
Anyway, what do we feel about this, Nick?
I mean, I'm for it. I like Jean Grey. She's never been my favorite, but I feel like good stories have come out of her character. Mm-hmm. So
we were talking about this off mic. We have a customer who we hadn't seen in a while who came by today who is in fact the biggest Jean Grey fan in the world and is very excited about this. But I was trying to think: is there anybody else in the entire world who's a super big Jean Grey fan? I think there are. Probably more than Iceman fans. Maybe?
I would think so.
A little bit more?
If I were ranking the original X-Men in terms of who should get an ongoing series from first to last...
Yeah.
Cyclops is number
Beast
one.
Beast is the top.
Oh.
Beast is the guy who can... Beast has never had an ongoing series, but you can't tell me that guy couldn't sustain an ongoing series.
He's a pretty personable guy.
Yeah.
He actually...
Avenger, he's been a Defender, he's been an X-Man, He is a scientist. He is a fun-loving blue furred beast.
I didn't know that we were going to go off topic here.
Look, beast is the best.
Well,
in fact, you take A out. You take A out. You have. You
it
have
literally
best.
Is the
you
best.
You cannot spell beast without best. That's my tagline. This is my pitch. I didn't know I was pitching, but I'm pitching.
All right, riding with it. You may have sold me. Because also, you know who else? His best friend is Wonder Man.
You do a, give me a Beast and Wonder Man series, I will buy every issue of that series.
Yep, yep.
Yeah. Get Tom Taylor to write it.
Damn. Write that. Be get, better than all the X-Men series going on right
Stuart
now.
Get Stuart Immonen on art.
Wow.
I want to call Marvel and pitch this now.
Swinging for the fences here.
Anyway.
It's another Tom Taylor Tuesday.
Anyway, Beast is on top.
Yep.
Right below that, I would say, is probably Jean Grey.
Yeah.
And then Cyclops, and then Iceman, and then Poor Angel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, anybody can be with the right writer.
Sure.
But,
absolutely.
But yeah, I like Jean. I'm kind of indifferent overall to her resurrection, but I'm certainly... the reason I mentioned the misremembering, I think, of people as to her number of deaths is I think we're going to hear a lot of... Oh, God, they're bringing Jean back.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Like, it's the millionth time. And I'm like, it really hasn't happened that often. Wolverine's probably been resurrected more often than she has. Anyway. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
All right, speaking of unlikely returns.
Nice segue.
We are, thank you. And last segue of the news.
All right.
I'm pretty proud of this week's segues. Don't forget, you can go to iTunes and give us a 5-star review, 5-star rating of how good my segues are.
Just the segues, though.
Just nothing in the headline, top segues.
Top segues.
A++ would buy again.
There is a new Marvel 2-in-1 series coming out.
All right.
It is under the Marvel Legacy banner, and yet, weirdly, is a number 1 instead of Legacy numbering, which just goes to show how stupid all this Legacy numbering is.
Yeah. For those who may not recall, since Marvel 2-in-1 has not been active for decades, perhaps?
Yeah.
That was just as... what was the one that had Spider-Man in it? Marvel
Team-Up
was Spider-Man and somebody.
Yep.
Marvel 2-in-1 was the Thing teaming up with somebody.
Yep.
Every issue.
So this one is... it's going to be Chip Zdarsky writing, Jim Chung on art, and it opens with a story called The Fate of the Four, with Johnny and Ben reuniting after spending the last few years between, you know, at Guardians and Inhumans
right.
and all that stuff, to go look for Reed and Sue, who are missing since the end of Secret Wars. Which, could this be the beginning of Fantastic Four revival?
Yes. And does that mean that Marvel thinks that they're going to be able to start making movies with them at some point?
Maybe.
It'd be interesting if it was all synergistic in that sense. I would like that to happen.
Stanley did say that they were going right. after him.
It's, of course, the exact kind of thing Stanley might generically say to promote anything.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we're working on it.
If I were to ask Stanley about this Beast book, Stanley would say, that's a great idea, kid. We're going to do it next week.
That's right.
What Stanley would say. So what Stanley says is not of much use to us anymore.
Right, but...
Aww.
But,
yeah, sorry,
but it could have meaning. You don't
it
know.
Could have meaning. I do think they're probably heading to build a Fantasy Four back.
This for sure, like... When you launch a book with trying to kind of put the band back together and
yep.
it's going to get some press and stuff.
Yep.
And you call your story Where Are the Four?
Or they were just so jealous of the Terrifics from DC, which will become the surrogate FF, the proxy
yeah.
FF,
yeah.
That they just had to do something about it quick.
Yeah, I think it's possible.
The only thing I'm worried about with this is Chip Zdarsky, honestly.
Yeah, I like Chip.
Chip is a great humorist. I have not been sort of won over on his dramatic side yet.
Yeah, me neither.
And I do need the FF to have some gravitas.
Yes. All right, that's it for news. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, September 20th. Dave, why don't you kick us off here with your first pick?
I wasn't ready, but I'll do it.
All right.
my pick this week was a book that I had not... It wasn't particularly on my radar, other than kind of was curious about it, which is Wonder Woman Conan, a DC Dark Horse crossover. Which, by the way, if Marvel and DC may not be friends, but there are crossovers aplenty going on in the world. Is Marvel doing any crossovers right now, or is it all just DC and pals?
It's mostly DC and pals.
It's mostly DC and pals. Marvel's not doing any crossovers.
Yeah, bums. Anyway, Wonder Woman Conan. The two legendary warriors meet in this. It is notably written by Gail Simone, with very awesome art by Aaron Lopresti. Is that who it is?
Yep.
As I was thinking about it when I made the sign for it yesterday, I was thinking, you know what, that could kind of come off pretty well. I could sort of see it. And Gail Simone has come up with a neat story that actually has some clever underpinnings that goes beyond just the whole let's get these two characters together and just watch some sparks.
Yeah, it's more Conan than Wonder Woman in this first issue.
Correct. And although she has a pretty major role.
She does
role.
Have some notable parts. But it felt to me like she was riffing on Busick's Conan.
Absolutely. He recalls in this, events where she's like, oh, I've heard that... a character that... It seems like a young version of her.
Maybe.
That has met in the that yeah. they've met in the past. There's a mystery involving it, but yeah. when he remembers somebody named Yana, which sounds like Diana, or a version of it.
Has a dumb Sumerian might pronounce it.
Exactly, but he remembers a girl from his youth, a mysterious girl that impressed him. And she's like, I heard you were the one who fought the wolf. And, you know, that goes to a story from the Busiek era or maybe shortly thereafter.
Yep.
One of those Born on the Battlefield stories.
Yep.
And there was a lot of... There did seem to be a lot of callbacks to it. But it does begin with a very awesome scene of Conan running into, like, some guys with these, like, red-hot tongs that are about to, like, crush a dude's face under it. And Conan's kind of like...
Yeah, that's a really cool weapon.
It's a cool weapon, and a different kind of fight comes out of this.
Yep.
And Conan's just walking by, and this dude is begging him to help. And it's one of those dramatic situations where Conan's kind of like, I don't really care what's going on in here. But the dude who they're about to kill, by the way, especially the guy is one of the people who's of the...
Aquilonians,
who have, like, conquered his people.
Yep.
So he has no love for him at all. But the guy's like, I'll pay. He's like, I'll pay big money. And Conan's like, you got my attention. And next thing you know, swords are drawn and Conan's fighting these guys. And it's a cool scene. And he does indeed fight a guy with giant, scourgingly hot tongs. He ends up teaming up with this kind of... a sort of skeevy thief who talks about an arena where he's put a lot of money on a woman betting against a female fighter.
Because the woman's not
going to win. You cannot imagine a woman possibly holding her own in the arena. This woman is, of course, Diana of Themyscira, a.k.a. Wonder Woman.
Yep.
There's several subplots, actually, working these two mysterious crows.
Yep.
That speak and are following on the trail of Conan. I thought Gail Simone did some fun, really fun dialogue with them.
This was really good. I wasn't sure what to expect, but it reads like a good Conan book.
Well,
I enjoyed it.
It does. Wonder Woman is being held in this arena, and you sort of find out that she doesn't have a full memory of what happened, but the rest of it I'll leave to people to find out. But both characters are well represented and well respected. They both get to be awesome in it, but without being just kind of showy. It's not just a showpiece or look how awesome they are.
Right.
There's for sure a story going on. I even like that the guy who runs the arena gave her the name. It means he must know something about where she came from, of Island Flower. But
yeah.
No doubt probably also is like an ironic thing. But that's what her gladiator name is. Beyond that, strong action sequences, good mystery, great meeting of the characters. Like, I actually liked everything about the scene where they first meet, which is an unusual scene. Promising stuff to come. I was much happier with it than I thought I would be. I expected it would be good, but of no interest to me particularly. And instead, it's probably going to be my pick of the week. Or it is my pick for the podcast, and should have a pick on the thing tomorrow.
Nick?
I am picking an Aftershock book entitled Dark Arc.
Dark Arc.
Yes.
It rhymes.
It does rhyme.
That's Dark Arc as in
A-R-K.
Not an arc of light, but Arc as in Noah's Ark.
Correct. And this is written by Cullen Bunn.
That guy never writes any comics.
Beautiful. And
I think you meant to say he wrote all the comics.
He does write all the comics. Beautiful artwork by Wando.
Oh, I like that guy.
But yeah, this actually does pertain to the story of Noah and his ark.
You mentioned that, and I wasn't sure if that was like literally...
Very much so.
Okay.
You have Noah and his ark, which contains all natural animals trying to survive the destruction of the world, so a new world can begin anew.
But there's a twist?
Well, or no, there is a second...
An addition.
There's a second arc.
Right.
That is filled with... magical beings like manticores and dragons.
The creatures of legend.
And creatures of legends and of monsters and harpies and all sort of things. And one family is sort of set to build this ark and kind of watch over it by maybe not God. Just think of the opposite. So
that's pretty clever.
But there's some...
Man, that art is sweet.
Yeah, no, it really is. And Wando's renditions of all these characters and all these creatures are just fantastic. But there's more to it than that. There's lots of ins and outs. As you imagine, many of these creatures have schemes of their own.
Right. Like, they're not a bunch of passive cows who will just chill until
I mean, I don't
reached.
Think a Lamia would sit there and just kind of not want to kill.
Right.
But there's also some humans aboard, which are sort of meant as cattle and food and sacrifices. And there's this family.
A little bit different than the traditional arc story.
But there's also this family who's been entrusted with this mission, and there's really some interesting work within not only the main guy, but his sons and daughters, very kind of mirroring Noah's story.
Okay.
But there's some really cool ideas here, and I think it's very well executed. And I knew nothing about this book other than I flipped through the art and I was like, oh, this looks good. And it surprised the hell out of me.
Nice. Always nice to get a nice surprise. I was just saying to somebody the other day in relation to movies that sometimes a movie that turns out to be a nice surprise and is good can actually feel better than a movie that's really good.
It's true.
Yeah, and... You know, I'm not... I mean, the Noah story is fine. I didn't really much care for the Noah movie, the Russell Crowe one a couple of years back.
I like it.
I know you do.
Die Hard on a boat, people.
I am indifferent.
But if you give me a...
You haven't seen it.
But if exactly. If you give me a boat full of monsters, I'm in.
You're saying they should go ahead and make a movie of this one?
I would see it. I'd love to see an animated film.
Yeah, the designs are really strong, and I could actually see them doing something like that.
Yeah.
It would be interesting. Has anybody tried to do... I guess they do direct-to-video things. Adult animation is my question. DC sort of does.
There's a lot of adult animation.
So DC sort of does, but there's no Ralph Bakshi of our time.
Right.
Nobody kind of... No heavy metal. I'd be interested to see that. I guess that's kind of... It is internet territory,
yeah.
But I can't think of any film that has generally been any good that's pulled it off. Anyway.
Maybe we don't know about it. Maybe we're too old.
There's an aside there. Yeah. Maybe people are like, I just kickstarted it and posted it on Instagram. How do you not know about it, old people?
Yeah, it's on Tumblr and
I swiped right and
Tinder, yes.
And yeah. All right. Well, Randy, what do you got?
I am picking Generations. We picked almost every one of these.
Why not one more?
This is Generations of the Marvels. It's G. Will Wilson, who created Ms. Marvel, writing about Kamala Khan, going back to the 70s, and basically working alongside Carol Danvers, her idol, when she was a younger editor of a magazine and just Ms. Marvel.
Was she supposed to be editor of, like, a feminist magazine?
In fact, that's what she goes back to. It's Woman Magazine.
Uh-huh.
And through a series of events, Kamala becomes Karina, an intern of this magazine.
Uh-huh.
That is struggling because they introduce Women's Lib and their sales are suffering.
Interesting.
Here's the weird thing. They don't specifically say it's the 70s, but it's very clearly the 70s.
Yes, right.
But they can't say it's the 70s because if it's the 70s, then Carol Danvers in the modern era is like 70 years old.
Right. The timeline doesn't work, but it's like there is something potent about her story. Yeah.
And
it actually
is
tied into
70s.
when it was breaking out.
So they sort of fudge that, but if you can get past that, and I can, this is another great story of Kamala Khan interacting with her hero, basically providing a sort of an inspiration to her and learning something about herself, along with fighting aliens, and there's a clever plot that drives the whole thing.
There's also some really fun Marvel Easter eggs in there,
yep,
too.
Yep, there are. This also has really, really cool artwork by Paolo Vianelli, and the colors, actually, by Ian Herring. It has a sort of 70s sepia tone going to it.
Yeah,
and it works really well. Like, I really like the art in this book, too. But yeah, it's I always like Kamala Khan. I like seeing her interact with Carol Danvers. I think they did some really good stuff here, and it's of a piece with all the other generation stuff, which is to say it's all really good. My backup pick is a comic that I think has fallen off people's radar. Usually people wind up picking this up in trades and hardcovers, but
I should say it's doing great in that capacity.
Yep. Injustice 2, number 10, which continues the story of the Injustice games, written by Tom Taylor, who is the guy who I believe should take over running all of DC Comics.
Yep.
And this is another example of why. He does some great stuff with... Basically, Ra's al Ghul has kidnapped the kids of a bunch of the superheroes as a means of keeping them under control. Batman and his team, which includes Wildcat and Green Arrow and Black Canary and Batgirl, are going in to rescue them. And so it's like the children of Black Lightning with their powers, Harlequin's daughter, and...
Oh, the kids of Black Lightning? That's cool.
And Green Arrow and Black Canary's son. And they've recruited Plastic Man and his son to go in and help them recruit them, to go and rescue them. There's some great throwdowns here. There's some great Harley Quinn moments. There's some great Wildcat moments. There's a surprise return of a DC superhero as sort of a secret weapon. There's some big reveals with the kids. Yeah, it's like everything I want in DC Comics is in Injustice.
Yeah, you were pointing this out to me, Randy, and like every few pages was some scene where I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yep.
Oh, what a cool character bit. That's really funny. That's really awesome. The Wildcat thing was super cool. The Harley scene was fantastic.
Yep.
So
this is actually a Harley Quinn I enjoy. I liked it better than any of the Harley Quinn stuff.
Right. It's sort of like what I was saying is from what I can see is Tom Taylor's version of how she's kind of evolved in this alt future or whatever is more like the Harley I would want to see, the sort of emancipated from the Joker Harley.
Yep.
In this case, because Joker's dead.
Yeah.
But in the books, just because she's like, she's had enough of this crap.
Yep.
But this is more the one I want than the kind of Deadpool wannabe that I sometimes feel she is.
Yep, I agree. This is Injustice is everything I want DC to be, and I want more of it, and I want Tom Taylor to take over the DC universe.
Yep.
But until that happens, we should read Injustice too.
Fair enough.
Dave, your backup?
Backup, Shirtless Bear Fighter 4. We've talked about this book for a while. It was a ridiculous and awesome book. Four issues in, I think it's closing in on the big finale.
Yeah,
it seems we're like
one more issue, actually.
The big threats have been revealed.
Yep.
I don't know if I should say who the threat is.
You shouldn't.
But it's amazing and just ridiculous as hell. What impressed me about this issue, aside from like some really funny stuff, is that there was actually a few little sort of sweet moments in there. Shirtless Bear Fighter's mother talking to is she like an agent friend
of
Shirtless Bear Fighter? There's actually sort of a sweet flashback story about her and getting a broken arm rescuing a cat when she was younger. Meanwhile, other bonds are forged between Shirtless Bear Fighter and his the rest of his family. Old wounds are mended in this to create a fighting force in which bears and humans might fight side by side.
Yep.
For their freedom. There's maybe the most spectacular punch sound effect that I can think of.
Yep.
I'd almost want to say it, but I won't.
Nope.
Because I think you need the context for it. There are any number of pictures that just made me laugh because of the way the stupid bears are drawn. whether there's bears being punched or hit by balls and chains during a prison breakout, evil bears being messed with, somebody gets sprayed with bear mace that has a hilarious picture of a little crying bear on it.
Yep.
Innovative use of bear traps in this. And also a big action scene, which I'm going to say is worthy of the big semi thing at the end of Smokey and the Bandit.
Yep.
But somehow bears are involved.
Yep.
And a giant sort of robotic threat. Anyway, Shirtless Bear Fighter is the book that the staff wants you to read, the book you need to read.
Agreed.
So just do it. Don't make me fight it.
Nick?
And I'm going to talk about a DC Metal crossover.
Metal.
And this is Dark Knight's Batman the Red Death. Which
it's a hardcore name.
Yeah.
The Red Death.
I mean,
it's
all
metal.
Of these guys are going to have hardcore metal names,
it's
because
true.
That's just what they are. But these basically are the birth of the kind of Batman dark versions of these characters.
And they're all dark analogs to the Justice League, right?
They're basically a dark version of Batman that is somehow circumvented like powers, those powers. Or
yeah, yeah.
This one tells of a story of Earth 52 and their Flash and how Batman basically utilizes the Speed Force to do what he needs to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a bizarre tale. It is a very dark and twisted kind of heavy metal tale. and it's actually written by Joshua Williamson and art by Carmine DiGiacomino. I can never pronounce that guy's last name. But it is the...
We're going to say correct.
But they are the people who do Flash right mm-hmm. now. So it is very much a piece of that. And it has sort of a Batman utilizing all the Rogue's weaponry, has some great back and forth between Barry and Bruce. There is a giant
You mentioned the Rogue's weaponry. I just saw a scene in there where Batman, like, over his cowl kind of has the little visor welding glasses looking things from...
Captain Cold.
From Captain Cold. That's pretty cool.
There is some brutal takedowns of villains.
Now, who is the lead in this?
Bruce, the sort of dark version of one of the dark versions of Bruce Wayne.
Is it the one that is it the Red Death guy?
Yes.
Okay, so
it is Red Death.
From the perspective of him.
Yes, and that's
his origin.
Yeah, it's okay. His origin. That's what all of these one-shots are going to be, sort of the origins of these characters.
And they're all bad guys, right?
Yes. Yep. They are birthed on the world of...
I thought it might be about the people who, like, oppose them or something like that, getting beat up by them.
No, dude. All for the bad guys.
Yeah, the dark multiverse is sort of destined to die, and these are all kind of, like... relics of dead worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it bleeds over into our world and sort of the chaos that these people bring to Central City and all of the other places as more and more stuff happens. I really enjoyed it.
I believe this is going to go over well with people.
Yeah, I think all these one-shots are going to do well.
DC Metal stuff, Dark Knight Metal has.
I will say, if you come in and you get here a little early, we will have pins that go with... These books.
They have the sort of Red iconic Death symbol insignia. Of the Red Death, yeah.
Yep.
What else is on your list, Nick?
Aquaman 28, which continues the tale of Arthur Curry and Dolphin versus the emissaries of a evil warlord that has taken over Atlantis.
Yep.
And it is beautifully rendered by Stefan Sedgwick. I think Dan Abnett is doing some great stuff. So I think more people should kind of turn their attention to this book because it is kind of Game of Thronesian with a little bit of superhero charm. So that one, Venomverse number 3, which introduces a wild card from Eddie Brock's past into the Venomverse and maybe a chance of them winning this fight against these creatures that are taking over Venom symbiotes.
Interesting.
The War of Jokes and Riddles sees its penultimate issue in Batman as sort of Joker's forces are taken down and Riddler's forces teaming up with Batman kind of are the people behind it. There's some funny one-liners.
Does Riddler have forces?
Well, Joker has an army, Riddler has an army. That was the whole sort of thing about the War of Jokes and Riddles. Huh? Like a bunch of supervillains side.
I usually think of the Riddler as a solo guy. Joker definitely always has henchmen. Well, honestly, Riddler often enough does too.
Snyder.
I just don't think of him as that much.
Snyder took the Riddler and kind of elevated him as being one of the major Batman villains and. Definitely.
Again, with Gotham has kind of done that too. They sort of made him also like a creepier dude, and I think they did the same here.
He's not so much creepy. He's just a little more lethal, maybe. But he's not like the evil. I mean, he's, I guess, kind of like the Arkham Knight ones.
Right.
Riddler. Maybe not as Saw-esque as that, but close.
Right.
Jean Grey number 7, which sees the young Jean Grey haunted by old Jean Grey's ghost and having a little talk with Scarlet Witch. And it's really, really great, as all of these issues have been. Nightwing 29, which is the second part to the Dark Knight's Metal tie-in series about Damian Wayne, Dick Grayson, Green Arrow, Harley Quinn, and the Suicide Squad teaming up in trying to find Batman. Then the 23rd issue of Totally Awesome Hulk sees after the exploits of Weapon H and all of the Weapon X stuff, Amadeus Cho gets kind of back to business. This also features Silk and Miss Marvel and a few other people that are really fun in the Marvel Universe. And then there's a Star Wars annual by Jason Latour, featuring Han Solo and Princess Leia versus some bounty hunters and aliens, and it was a lot of fun too. Beautiful art by Michael Walsh, which I'm not familiar with him, but it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. That is all that's on my stack.
Dave?
Just a few to add. I wanted to mention Future Quest Presents Space Ghost, number 2. I know the number of people actually kind of dropped the Future Quest that they were following when this came out, but I think that they should come back to it, because in some ways this is more what I wanted than the somewhat disjointed Future Quest before. Mm. This is a very focused story that has Space Ghost teaming up with the Herculoids. Okay. It's just like two of the favorite properties among those. You get to see really cool stuff going on. They're going through these dangerous underground caverns on this one planet that has to do with trying to get the same more material that make up the bands that he does that do all his cool weapon stuff. And Igu, the big old rock man that from the Herculoids, is teaming up with him and the why can't I remember the name of the kids? Anyway, the
Jason,
kids and yeah,
Jaina.
And Jaina and Gleek. Anyway, it's very cool. It feels like a slightly more, you know, cooler version of basically the old cartoon stuff. But I'm really enjoying it. And I think it's more focused than the Future Quest stuff was before. Let's see. Simon Spurrier has new book Angelic from Image. Angelic number 1 hits. I actually haven't had a chance to read this yet, but I liked the weird premise. It's sort of an apocalypse has brought down humanity, but what remains behind is a weird mixture of, like, all the genetically modified animals and stuff that had happened up to that point.
Yeah.
So there's these weird, like, there's, like, dolphins in, like, you know, mech suits, sort of, that are gliding around through the air that have been, like, uplifted. There's weird genetically modified flying monkeys and stuff. I don't know if the tone is, like... there's comedic stuff in it, but it doesn't look like it's a comedy overall. It also has like sort of some sort of serious apocalyptic stuff in it. I think they described it as Wall-E meets Watership Down.
Yeah, I can see that.
And then lastly, a collected edition from DC, which is the Legion series by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning. This, I think, was sort of following, Randy, you said, Mark Waid's run, and
yep.
They had done that Legion Lost transition stuff.
Yep.
But this is the volume that collects the official start of their Legion run, a pretty fabled run, you know, maybe the last sort of notable, really good run that I think Legion has had.
Also, the introduction of Olivier Coppia was his first stuff.
That's right. I know that we have a lot of fans here who came around to Abnett and Lanning's work over at Marvel with Annihilation and
yeah.
the various spinoffs and Guardians of the Galaxy, which went on to become a small grossing film,
yeah.
a small independent cult film.
It's done all right.
If you want to see some other stuff from those guys that was, you know, equally smart sci-fi, you're going to want to check out their Legion run.
Yep. All right, I got a few things.
Hit it.
Big Trouble Little China, Old Man Jack. This is the, basically, Jack Burton is an old man. The world has been overtaken by some kind of a supernatural apocalypse. And Jack is called into action for one last mission. It's kind of fun and goofy, and if you like the Big Trouble Little China Escape from New York stuff, it's in a vein with that. Bloodshot Salvation, which is a sort of post-apocalyptic take on Bloodshot in some ways. It is a... sort of a future of Bloodshot where he's dealing with the Bloodshot virus and that kind of thing. I believe a lot of it takes place in the modern day, but it is also presaging possibly a dangerous future where the Bloodshot virus is causing problems. So.
Interesting.
Killed Minotaur number 4. I'm still enjoying that book quite a bit. It's wrapping up another issue. U.S. Avengers number 10, which big status quo change in the wake of the Secret Empire. This is mostly an issue of transition, which this team has had a few of, as Roberto Da Costa faces off with sort of a slimy U.S. senator who's trying to reuse his team for their own purposes. He managed to turn the tables on him, spoilers, and they're sort of checking in on where all the team members are. I really like this book. I wish more people were reading it. I think it's a strange little book, but I really like these teams. It reminds me of everything I like about a good super team book.
People shouldn't mess with Sunspot.
I agree. X-Men Gold number 12, which is a one-shot focusing on this new alien named Kolagoth, who was a member of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. He sort of showed up. This reveals his history and sort of positions him to be more of a big bad. And I'll be interested to see see where they go with that.
It's a cool concept.
Also teases the Mojo crossover that's coming between X-Men Gold and X-Men Blue. Black Hammer number 13 continues to be a book where if someone were to say, what's Black Hammer about? I'd have a hard time describing it, but I love every issue.
Jeff Lemire is pretty good at that sometimes.
Yep. And then Wildstorm number 7, which is more of a crazy espionage in the Wildstorm universe by Warren Ellis. This is really everything I liked about Wildstorm. It is a universe where instead of superheroes, everyone is like a covert op. And this kind of thing can get old, but if you like Warren Ellis' stuff, it's a really well-done series. There is the hardcover collection of TMNT Usagi Yojimbo. Same thing as the one-shot that was produced, but it also has some backup material, some extra covers, all that kind of stuff. And it's a nice hardcover production.
It's very pretty.
And then also I want to mention the Daredevil Man Without Fear Epic Collection. This is a run that happened in the late 80s, I think?
Yeah.
Maybe early 90s?
Yep.
Yeah, 89 to 1990 is the year here. A lot of it's written by Ed Nascenti with John Romita Jr. on art. And it's this weird thing where Daredevil gets involved in sort of this spiritual quest. He, like, faces off with Dr. Doom. He faces off with Ultron. Mephisto is working against him. It is a crazy take. And it's also where they introduced Typhoid Mary.
Right.
It's
Innocenti did a lot of, I noticed when I was among her stuff, strange and sort of personal stories and stories that where, you know, the superhero world veers into politics and, you know, social critiques and things like that. And but also uses some big Marvel heavy hitters. I remember buying some of these issues once upon a time just because I love Romita's art in it, actually. He draws a mean Daredevil, and, like, his Ultron is epic.
Yeah, there's some great
all, everybody he gets to draw in this is epic.
By the way, I was wrong. Typhoid Mary, maybe she shows up later. She is not in this run.
Okay.
Oh, there she is at the very end. Anyway, yeah, this is a Daredevil era that I have not read all of, but everything I've read I really liked, and I kind of want to go back and check it out.
I think that perhaps more than any other Daredevil run, there's nothing really quite like this
one. That's true. All right, we'll be back in just a second to talk about some movies and some TV and that kind of stuff. All right, as we do every now and then, we like to check in on what pop culture we are consuming. And in the case of you guys, that's horror movies.
Yep.
Nick? Tell us about Darren Aronofsky's Mother. I've heard some mixed things.
Yeah, I don't want to go into too much detail because it's hard to talk without spoiling something, and this one is one of those movies that you want to go in knowing as little about it as you can.
Yep.
But if you like Aronofsky, if you've liked Black Swan or Requiem for a Dream, you kind of have a feel of what he brings to the table and sort of kind of his eccentricities and the way he tackles stories.
Yep.
This one is, the only thing I will say is sort of an allegory. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's not what the previews are telling it is.
If I were to guess based on the previews, newly married, perhaps, couple, Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem. A strange guest or series of guests show up at his place, and there's something sinister going on, and it's a cult, and they're going to sacrifice her or something like that.
Man, I hate when that happens.
And things get super intense because the ad was all used creepy music and weird, chilling sound effects and stuff like that. Is that not what the movie is exactly, Nick?
No, that is not exactly. There are elements of what you just described that are parts of the movie.
Yeah.
And I will say,
Drama?
It is. Like, it's more
of a drama.
On its
path to whatever it goes. I know there's...
It's like a thrilling drama-ish.
No. Did you like it?
I'm not a big Aronofsky fan. I thought it was okay. And I'm weird because apparently most people either love it or hate it.
Well, I've seen the reviews have been brutal.
Well, it got an F from one of the most notable review places, not Rotten Tomatoes. It's like, I actually forget the name of the place.
Well, I saw someone, was it Rolling Stone? Someone called it basically like a college student's LSD trip, you just back from a big LSD trip and wrote it down.
I will say, though, it is one of those movies that once you get out of it, you sort of want to talk to somebody about it. I mean, my wife and I had
an interesting
conversation about it, but...
In a therapy kind of way?
I've seen a number of people express that sentiment, though.
Not in a therapy kind of way, but just, you know how a movie kind of... yeah. what you want to talk about when it, we in saw sort of the scenes it explores.
Yes. I wanted to talk about Split.
Yeah. yeah. So I do recommend people seeing it. I don't know if I would rush out and see it. I think it kind of is getting overhyped and like where you will always remember when you saw Mother.
yeah.
I thought that little bit in the trailer was a bit much.
Where were you on 9/11 and where were you when Mother happened?
But I love all the people involved. I mean, Jennifer Lawrence is great.
So
Javier Bardem is fantastic. Michelle Pfeiffer, she's phenomenal. And Ed Harris is one of those guys that pretty much is in a movie, and I'll go see it.
He's always commanding on screen.
Yes.
What I was going to say is that I am also not a big Aronofsky fan, but any of his movies that I've sat down to watch, I've always found pretty compelling. So talking about The Wrestler, Black Swan, Pi, Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
Of them all, really, the only one I really like, and this is, like, sounds all hipster, but it's the sort of rawness of the original Pi.
Yeah.
I really like that. It's also that kind of falls in my wheelhouse of sort of suspense horror.
Well, and you like movies about pie.
I do, that's true.
I haven't seen Pie, so I'm just guessing what it's
like. I felt like most of his other movies are a little overblown. I was telling you that
the structure I see that underlies every single one of the ones I just named is a downward spiral that gets more and more intense as some pivotal event or something comes up and somebody's life is about to spiral off into total destruction, usually.
That's a good estimation of what the movie is.
I had a feeling. He has a speed that he likes to use.
It's one to discuss, and I would suggest seeing it, but I don't know if I would rush.
And also keep the expectations moderate and maybe not keyed in on what the trailer showed.
Exactly.
Like, don't expect a chilling horror movie in the style of Insidious.
Yeah. I kind of went in wanting a Rosemary's Baby, so I was a little disappointed in that regard. But if my expectations had been keyed down a little bit and lowered, I might have enjoyed it more.
And I was high.
I mean, that wouldn't have hurt.
Dave? You were going to talk about The Invitation, which is a movie that Nick talked about that we forgot.
A few months ago.
Yep.
And you said that you thought it would be kind of hard to describe without giving away everything.
Correct.
So I came up with a possibility for what I thought it was about, having never even seen a show.
Go for it. Hit it.
And what I said was that maybe it was about a wedding invitation that goes out, and someone has to decide whether or not to go to the wedding, and they ultimately go, and they go on this plane, and there's a sassy captain who makes jokes with the intercom. And there's a funny grandma and her kid and her grandson, and they stay up front. And she says things like, "Oh no, you didn't."
Is this sort of like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles? And you're like, "Is he ever going to fulfill the invitation?"
Yes. And at the end, the guy goes and he says, "I'm glad I accepted your invitation." Is it like that?
And then probably the family or something is reunited.
Yeah, exactly. Just like at the end.
I'm shaking my head. I mean, that's what it's about, right?
Let me just say, you're in the ballpark.
Am I close?
You're in the ballpark.
Yeah.
So The Invitation is...
There is an invitation.
I guess it's like... It's really a pretty indie horror movie. I'd maybe lean towards suspense. But I don't want to say too much about it. But it is... It's the slowest of slow burns. It's a very talky movie. But I never found it anything less than super engrossing. Starts with a couple who has indeed been invited to a... kind of a fancy schmancy house out in the hills of L.A.,
yeah,
and it's an invitation from his ex. They've been apart, seems like, several years now, and he's trepidatious about seeing her again. They clearly, you find out sort of through some flashbacks and discussion, a tragedy kind of, whatever problems they might have had, a tragedy in their life pushed them apart that had to do with a kid. And
both of them sort of to a breaking point, and he reacted one way, she reacted another, and it just split the relationship down the middle.
And there's also, even just getting there, something very intense happens, which I don't want to say what it is, but it sort of sets a keynote for the rest of the story. And when they get there, it's like a bunch of old friends, ultimately probably 10 or so people, I think, are there. They all know each other. They're all kind of late 20s, early 30s, kind of well off.
It's sort of like if the members of the movie The Big Chill got back together, but added this really weird kind of off-put kind of bizarre tone.
Suffice to say, it's told from the perspective of this guy who's the hostess's ex,
yeah,
and he senses something is off. that something is amiss here. There's a few people he doesn't know that he's not wild about. There's some of the way his ex is acting is a little bit unnerving. But he's also kind of himself, because of the trauma that he experienced, seems a little paranoid.
Yeah.
And it's hard to kind of tell what's happening. I will say there was some funny stuff in it too. Yeah. There's the characters' interactions. Some of it is just sort of normal stuff at a party, and then there's like it always felt like kind of tense.
Yeah.
And like I never knew where it was gonna go. Hmm. And so I was like fascinated the whole time. Just I was like, is this what I think it is? Is it completely not what I think it is?
And I think that's something that's saying something about a movie that you keep questioning yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that's what
they were able to throw me around any number of times and still have what I thought was a very satisfying ending to it.
Yeah.
I also thought that it was it was really well acted.
Yeah.
I did not know a single one of the people in this movie, and they were all awesome. I felt like it was one of those where, because there's a lot of sort of people interacting at once sometimes, multiple kind of conversations going on, I felt like you could in any given scene go in and watch just one character who's like not even the main character, and there would be good acting going on, and then like a character that felt like they were, had their own motivations for being there, and was, you know, the actor was doing a great job portraying him. So, without saying too much about it, very intense and unsettling sort of, character piece. I don't know quite what to compare it to.
Yeah,
it almost felt Hitchcockian and like Rope or something, in that it was all in one sort of place for the most part. But just know that it is not a high tension horror thing or suspense thing, except a little bit at times.
What I'm hearing is that it's exactly like Soul Plane. That was my pitch. I'm sorry, that was my pitch.
Yes. I believe you have heard what you needed to hear, Randy.
Yes.
And our audience has heard what they need to hear, and they can make their own decisions there.
And it's their decision. Don't listen to Randy.
Incidentally, the reason this popped on my radar was there's a one of our former staffers, Amanda. She and I both shared a fondness for horror, and she'll occasionally point something my way. And there's a horror podcast from Blumhouse Productions, who does all these horror movies lately.
Yeah.
And they... it's called like Shockwave or something like that. I'm actually forgetting it. But they had a podcast. The first one I decided to try out of their podcast. There's a bunch of people, I guess, who are like, I don't know if they're just staff for Blumhouse Productions. They're not like the writers and directors, I think. I think they're some sort of other staffers. But they were doing their best horror movies of 2016, and this showed up on that.
Huh.
And several people mentioned it. They, you know, they did it. Each person went through a top 10 list. Sometimes they would overlap, sometimes they wouldn't. And I heard this one mentioned several times, and they always seemed to be talking around it so you wouldn't find out the secrets. But anyway, broadly would recommend the podcast too, just from what I've heard of it there.
Okay.
They seem like a good bunch of people.
All right. So I want to talk about a couple shows that I started watching. One is The Deuce, over on HBO. This is the new ones from David Simon and George Pelicanos, who are responsible for a lot of great TV, but notably The Wire.
That's a pretty notable show.
This is set in the 1970s in Times Square, and it is about...
the rise?
Oh, it's about the rise of pornography, but it's not just that, because it starts out, and it's about... these guys do big ensemble pieces. And so they've got James Franco playing twin brothers, one of whom is like this gambler guy, and the other one is like a bar manager, who basically... gets this idea to start dressing up his he's trying to save this Korean place because nobody eats Korean food in New York, not in the 70s.
Right.
And so he basically has all the waitresses dress up in like Danskin tights.
Right.
And sort of this, it creates sort of a Playboy Club type atmosphere.
Right.
And sort of he started animating that direction. Meanwhile, there's a prostitute played by Maggie Gyllenhaal,
mm-hmm.
who is out on the streets with other prostitutes. There's a big focus on the prostitutes and the pimps. And some kind of funny interaction between the pimps as they talk about politics and mix that in. But there's...
I gather this is not like a slick, sexy production, but more of kind of a gritty, tawdry...
Guys,
it's the tawdry 70s.
Yeah, these guys definitely do sort of a realistic... It's not dry.
Right.
But it is sort of a more grounded version of this. And they're going to be getting into sort of the development of pornography. Right now, it's like the cops are raiding the place. You can't actually have pornography. It's all underground.
Right.
And it's going to be going into the place where it started showing up in theaters on Times Square. And you know, how prostitution and law enforcement, and if you know David Simon, you know he's always fascinated by, like, institutions and how they interact. So it's going to be, like, how the institutions of prostitutions and pimps and...
Police
and all those things...
And the public, I'm sure.
All intersect. And so he's got, like, this girl who's basically dropping out of NYU, and she's going to be part of it. There's a girl who comes from the Midwest to become a prostitute. There are prostitutes in town. They're deliberately going out of their way to not be, like, it's not misogynist look at sex work and that kind of thing.
Right.
It's fascinating, it's really interesting, and it's super compelling. And it's dark, but it's yeah, it's something I cannot take my eyes off of. So I highly recommend it. It's only two episodes in right now. I also want to mention, on the flip side of things, Netflix has a new show called American Vandal that is their take on... They had a show called Making a Murderer.
Yeah.
Which right. was a true crime about a murder suspect right. and
pretty
and,
riveting.
It's on a riff on, you know, what Serial was on podcasts, what The Jinx was for HBO. American Vandal is basically a spoof of it. It right. is instead of the central crime being a murder or a rape or something, you know, like that, it is who drew all the dicks on the teacher's car during a staff meeting and then erased the security tapes. And they think they've got this one kid, this sort of dumb kid who does prank videos on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
But he's saying he didn't do it. So the student film club, the what do they, I think they call them the something nine, there's nine of them.
Uh-huh.
They're the ones who do sort of the morning show. One of them is doing a Serial style documentary
uh-huh.
about who drew the dicks. And they talk to the Spanish teacher who they believe was her revenge against her. And the thing about this, it's funny anyway, but it is such a dead-on, like, serious version of these shows. Like, they've got the maps, and they've got the scenarios, and they get the twists and turns of things they yeah. uncover. It's eight episodes. I've only seen six of the eight, but it's really good. It's so straight-faced about its parody that it works really, really well.
Right, like, it takes itself very seriously, even though the thing is ridiculous.
The thing is ridiculous.
I'm
yeah.
gonna have to watch this. That's
it's,
awesome.
It's really fun, and I'm greatly enjoying it. And then, Nick, I think you wanted to mention a show you were watching on Discovery.
I know. It weirded me out that I don't watch anything on Discovery. I don't know why that is. But this one, which is called Manhunt Unabomber, I peruse Rotten Tomatoes a lot just to see and get reviews for things for fun. And this one popped up.
When you
up.
Say peruse, I imagine you, like, kicking back in a lounge chair with, like, a newspaper
yes.
and your smoking jacket, and you're like, I think I'm going to peruse the Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
Sure. I mean, you can picture that if you'd like.
I assume it's something like
it's
that.
It's more than me sitting in bed on my phone.
it's the modern-day equivalent.
I mean, pretty much.
I guess.
But I ran across that this show was getting really high praise. So I was like, oh, I think I'll find it. Found it on my Fire Stick on Discovery's app, and it's starring Sam Worthington, Paul Bettany, and sort of takes place...
Sam Worthington's not necessarily something you want.
He's really good here.
Actually, the funny thing is that Sam Worthington, if I'm not mistaken, he was the dude in Avatar, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Blue People Avatar.
Yep.
But I had seen him previous to that in, like, a low-budget like New Zealand production of Macbeth, where he was, like, I think he actually played Macbeth himself. And it was, like, it reinvented it as, like, this kind of gritty, slick crime drama.
Yep.
And I remember he was actually quite good in it.
Is it, like, possible that James Cameron just brought out the worst in him?
Yeah, I think Cameron, like, I think doesn't necessarily, the way he sometimes brought out the best in the 80s, I think he just did not, yeah, it was not a movie that pushed him where he needed
to be. Because this series, I've only seen
seven. So I believe you that he could actually be really pretty legit.
Well, I've only watched seven episodes, and this actually recounts the tale of the Unabomber.
Right. Which I lived through, but don't know much about other than... They would occasionally, it would pop up in the news, a bomb would go off, or they'd have some lead, and eventually they caught the crazy guy with the beard.
Yes. Well, I mean, it was, like, the longest running, like, serial killer forever. He went stretches of, like, 6 to 7 years without,
and
like,
he had a particularly strange goal. He was, like, very anti, he was anti-technology.
Yeah, anti-technology. And it sort of focuses on one FBI profiler who is kind of laughed at, but he's sort of coming up with a new kind of style of catching people, like idioms and how people speak and talk and write their own language and how that pertains to where they've grown up and everything. And most of the FBI people were kind of laughing at it because no one had ever heard of anything like this.
Right, but it's sort of like next level profile.
Yeah, and they were sort of doing all this on the fly, trying to figure it out because that had been so long since anyone had had any leads.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of the story is kind of riveting. It's produced by Kevin Spacey. It's just really top-notch, slickly made, kind
Who
of...
Who are the leads?
Sam Worthington plays the FBI profiler.
Okay, yeah, yeah. And then... What are their fictional characters?
Paul Bettany plays the Unabomber. And
oh, so you do see stuff from his perspective?
There is stuff from his perspective, and it's interesting.
I wonder
interesting.
If he'd be off-camera or not.
Does he have Unabomber vision?
He does not. It kind of jumps back and forth through time, like... to when it was at its height, to no, just in story, and to after he's caught and sort of how the connection between the person who caught him and the Unabomber kind of has brought them together in a way.
Right.
There is kind of this weird kind of synergy.
Right. It makes sense to tell a story like this, maybe jumping around in time a little bit.
Yeah, but it feels kind of Silence of the Lambs meets something David Fincher would come up with.
Like his upcoming serial killer show.
Yeah.
Mindhunter.
Yeah. Mindhunter, which I'm super excited for. Yeah. But I'm really, really digging this show, and I think more people need to seek it out.
It's actually, among the various things just discussed, the Deuce and this one, which is also is called what now? Something
Manhunt
and a Unabomber.
Yeah,
Manhunt, I guess there's Unabomber. No missing based on if you can find that. Remember to look for the title that has Unabomber in it.
Yeah. You're gonna find the Unabomber Follies from 1970s.
Stargate Unabomber.
Stargate Unabomber.
but it's reminding me that Paul Bettany has a wide range of acting ability because mm-hmm. you know now people think of his vision.
Or an albino assassin, right? Wasn't he the albino assassin?
Yeah, he was the albino assassin.
Or a physicist's imaginary friend. Spoilers.
Yeah, wasn't he also the guy from Knight's Tale?
That's right, that's Chaucer.
I forgot. Yes.
But he is a legit actor, despite playing some wonky roles that might lead you to think he's a novelty actor.
Yeah.
He also played an angel in that terrible movie. I don't remember what the terrible movie was called, but he played an angel.
Okay.
He's also married to Jennifer Connelly.
Yes, I sort of remember that. Good job, Paul Bettany.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that sounds really interesting. I'm going to try and catch it in the next week or two.
Yeah.
All right. That wraps it up for us this week. Until next time.
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.